Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, Australia is in the middle of one of the most difficult debates for years. More fractious and personal than the Republic debate, at least as difficult as the gun debate, because it goes to the issues of personhood, identity, morality and freedom, especially religious freedom. Open House, and the Christian radio stations behind it, take the view that marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman. That's in line with biblical teaching and both church and societal tradition over thousands of years. We also take the view that our role as Christian broadcasters is to present a balanced and fair discussion of the many issues that would concern Christians during this period, in which we're being asked as a nation, by our government no less, to express a view. Our intention and desire is to do that in a way that's respectful, rejecting vilification and hate speech. We want to hear and test different viewpoints, and in particular, do so in a way that serves our community, Christians and people interested in advancing Christian thought. Many radio stations have adopted these principles for the present debate, and you can find more detail about the charter adopted by Hope 103.2 in Sydney and 96.5 Family Radio in Brisbane on their respective websites. In previous weeks, we've spoken with a number of people about the concerns of Christians around the redefinition of marriage and its potential consequences, especially for religious freedom. This week, a coalition called Australian Christians for Marriage Equality was launched to support a yes vote. It's arguing the case for the redefinition of civil marriage, not church marriage. They believe the social meaning of marriage has evolved, as they would put it. One of the main spokespeople for the group is the very Reverend Dr. Peter Catt. He's a convener of Progressive Christian Voice and is also the Dean of the St. John's Anglican Cathedral in Brisbane.
Thank you very much.
The group Christians for Marriage Equality, what kind of a group is that?
Christians for Marriage Equality is really a coalition of groups that have come together under that banner to represent the yes case as people of faith while the nation has the marriage postal vote survey, I don't know what you'd call it, exercise, I suppose. Yeah.
You had another word in mind then, didn't you?
I did, yes. Melee was one another word.
But why do you think of it as a melee?
Hopefully not a melee. I mean, we want our contribution to be one that simply places the case before people and wants to avoid, as your radio station does, wants to avoid promoting hate speech or belittling the other side.
Yes.
Fully respecting that there are Christians who hold diverse views on this issue. There are people who are confused, and I think if Christians who are for and who are against enter into the dialogue with a spirit of openness and wanting to help people understand their position, then that will help those who are struggling to make up their mind.
Indeed. Well then, on what basis does your group support the change in definition of marriage from what it is currently to marriage between any two persons?
I think the easiest way to describe it is to say that we can see that marriage has been an evolving institution over time. There was a time when the normative understanding of marriage had women submitting to their husbands, and certainly in many churches it's now seen as the bride and the groom are seen as equals, and there have been other evolutionary aspects to marriage. People have got older in getting married. We see it now as a celebration of love, whereas some wedding services in the past saw it as a move to make sure we didn't fall into sin. And so we see that extending marriage to people of the same gender is the next step in celebrating a loving commitment made in a public forum. So we see that's how marriage is becoming. We see it as marriage is a becoming thing rather than a static thing.
I understand. Now, of course, that does argue, as you've suggested, against centuries of tradition, not just in church tradition, but also the tradition of societies. John Dixon on our program a month or so ago was pointing out that, in fact, while same-sex relationships were certainly recognised in the Roman Empire, it wasn't called marriage, though, because marriage was regarded as being defined by the ability to produce and care for children in a, you know, male and female relationship.
Sure, but if we were going to be really hard and fast on a definition like that, then we would ask people to have fertility tests before we allowed them to get married, and we wouldn't marry older persons. So I think in our society, marriage has been evolving. You know, one of the things that really strikes me is that I've been advocating for the recognition of same-sex unions for nearly 30 years, and I know that 30 years ago, if I'd suggested to my gay or lesbian friends that I was going to advocate for them to get married, they would have labelled me as a fascist, I think. because back then they weren't interested in marriage because they saw it as patriarchal, they saw it as hierarchical. And I think what's happened in the last 10 or 20 years, the character of marriage has been slowly but surely shifting more and more to the celebration of love between two people, and the marriage ceremony has become the expression of their commitment to each other. And I think now the heterosexual community has changed marriage so that it's something that now same-sex couples can see themselves in. And so I think it's just part of how the institution of marriage has evolved, and whilst it hasn't, there's no historical precedent. If we believe evolution is something that takes us into the future, then there's no reason why this can't be a new, fresh expression of marriage, just as, you know, as 30 years ago we got rid of the submission line.
What for you is the purpose of marriage?
For me, the purpose of marriage is to provide society with a recognisable form of relationship that reminds us who is committed to whom, and provides a sort of a safe, stable, basic unit for society. And the basic unit, I think, is the couple. And sometimes there are children and sometimes not. And increasingly, I think we're moving away from children being part of marriages.
And do you think that's a desirable thing?
Well, given some of the other complexities we face, like overpopulation and climate change, I suspect we're going to have to celebrate the fact that there are people who wish to get married and don't want to have children. You know, overpopulation, you know, this is another side issue, but I think overpopulation means that we're going to have to encourage people to think carefully about the number of children they have, if any. And I know that for many millennials, the idea of having children is something they don't, for the sake of the planet, they're choosing not to have children. It's amazing change from when I was younger, but I think that's part of the evolution of society at the moment.
Well, it's certainly a change, although those changes come and go, and
indeed,
there's a sort of fashion attached to them, notwithstanding some of the environmental issues. And I suppose that's at the heart of one of my other questions to you, which is there a point at which matters of faith remain true because they're true, because they're biblically true, because they are given by God as truth, and don't change with fashion?
Oh, there certainly would be things that fit into that category. Church practice would suggest that marriage isn't one of them, because our practices of marriage have changed over time. There will be those, of course, who argue that the fundamental is a man and a woman, and I respect that view. It's not the view I hold. Marriage is an important institution that gives us some reliability in the way we organise our society, and for me it's the natural thing for it to include same-sex attracted people.
Hmm. Well, of course, you can't get away from the question of children. If you go to the Bible, and the key verses really are around that God made us to be male and female, and then Jesus' reference to that when a man leaves his father and mother and he unites with a woman and they become one flesh. So they have this incredible God-given ability to make another human being.
Sure.
Now, and I do hope, and it's so often the case that if you enter this territory, you enter this territory with trepidation because people say you're down on people that don't have children. Certainly, that I can assure you that's not the case.
Yeah, no, I understand.
You're down on,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
So if we can sort of put that to one side and say definitely, it's important to our society that children are regarded as being cared for within and knowing their natural mother and their natural father. That seems to me to be not just a biblical truth but common sense.
Well, I would argue that they certainly need a stable family, and I think one of the traps we fall into in the West these days is we forget that historically children have been raised by villages rather than by nuclear. The nuclear family is a rather late. The nuclear-separated family is a rather late invention, and I know that my kids actually benefited from being raised by multiple adults in the parish communities in which I lived when my kids were young. The kids had a number of women who they referred to as aunties who had no biological connection but were part of their raising unit, if you like. And I think that children benefit from a wide range of adult input and support. And that's particularly true given that you know, each of us has our foibles and our failings, and that if children are only seen as being influenced by their direct parents, then if those parents are far from perfect, then the children are not going to have good modelling. Whereas by seeing them as being brought up by a village, by a group of people, you can have a whole bunch of male role models and female role models, and then you end up with a very positive, I think you end up with more rounded people.
But I don't think anybody's really arguing against that idea, and no, all of us would hope that our extended families and our friends were part of the village that makes up our child, and in many ways we choose schools exactly for that purpose. But surely the importance of a child being able to know their biological mother and their biological father, and if possible be cared for by them, is that not a sort of primary objective?
It's one of the objectives, but I know kids that have been brought up in same-sex families because they're already with us. So
yes, of course they are.
So part of the how that's actually part of the marriage debate is actually not really clear to me.
Well, can I have a crack at that? I think
these families already exist. So
well, that's right. But can I have a crack at that question? Because
yeah, sure.
I think it's really important. If that's already possible,
yes,
then you could say, then why is a change necessary? And if marriage has always had one definition, does it matter that you know, why do you want to change the definition of the word marriage if it's already possible to do all of the things that we've just spoken about?
Yeah, partly because I think marriage is changing to, in my view, is that marriage is evolving and is evolving to include people of same gender. And so for me, it's a natural development in what marriage is. And I understand that I can see what people are getting at with the contrary arguments. I'm just not convinced by them.
Our guest on Open House tonight, Dr. Peter Catt. Reverend Dr. Catt is with the group Christians for Marriage Equality. So we were talking earlier about, are there universal truths that don't change with societal expectations, or as you've called it, evolution of society?
Yep.
So what other universal truths would you think were not going to change with the evolution of society?
Oh, the primacy of love and the call to look after the alien and the widow and the stranger, to bring people into community rather than exclude people. I think those deep heartbeats that start in the Old Testament and which get a particular clarity in Jesus, I think those truths run deep in the tradition and unify the tradition. One of my other hats is I'm the chair of the Australian Church's Refugee Task Force, and one of the things that constantly moves and impresses me is the is the unified voice of the churches when it comes to defending the asylum seeker and the refugee, and how deeply held that sense of caring for the alien and the stranger and providing a place of welcome unifies the traditions, despite all the other theological separations we might have and conversations we need to have. Going to a refugee rally and seeing so many Christians from so many traditions, and when we do our refugee work here, getting so much support from people right across the spectrum of the churches shows that there's a deep truth there about the value of all people.
Yes.
And those deep truths, I think, are the unalienable truths that we get from the idea that we're all made in the image of God, and that God loves us all, and God wants us to be loving to each other.
Yes. Our guest on Open House, Reverend Dr. Peter Catt, Dean of St. John's Anglican Cathedral in Brisbane, and amongst other things, one of those involved this week in the launch of Christians for Marriage Equality. Well, to return to the marriage question then, many Christians are concerned because of its implications for religious freedom questions, and I'd be very interested to get your views on that. So there are Christian schools that are worried about what they'll be able to teach. There are churches, indeed, worried about what they'll be able to say, given certain cases that are taking place in Tasmania and elsewhere about standard teachings of the church being challenged in the Anti-Discrimination Tribunal. Where does your group stand on those matters?
Our group firstly says that the Marriage Act is a very simple act, which only deals with the process of making sure that people go through a process that sees them legally married. And the current conversation is only about changing that act. And the current act and all the draft acts that I have seen give provision for religious celebrants to refuse to take any marriage. And you don't even have to give a reason. That's the current act holds that, and all the drafts I've seen of.
I think you'd have to be registered as a religious celebrant.
That's right.
Yes,
exactly right. All religious celebrants.
But then that doesn't go to other people in the community, people that, for whatever reason, if it's their religious, conscientious belief, don't want to be effectively forced by law or even taken to the court by third parties, as it was the case for that poor old cake maker in the United States. The cake maker, the couple who asked for the cake were apparently quite happy that she wouldn't make them a cake. It was the state that took her to the court.
Well, and see that, but that's a different conversation to changing the Marriage Act.
Well, isn't it a consequence of it?
Well, no, it's a conversation that goes to the heart of anti-discrimination legislation. And anti-discrimination legislation already includes provisions for people for schools, for example, to exercise their religious freedom. And so there may be some conversation we want to have about should we discover that there are consequences of changing the Marriage Act that might need to be looked at in terms of anti-discrimination legislation, but that's a different piece of legislation, and there's no sense in which no one's talking about reducing the capacity of schools to exercise. You know, there's no concomitant change to the Anti-Discrimination Act. At the moment, the Anti-Discrimination Act allows schools and other religious organisations to be exempt for certain employment, and no one's thinking about changing that, because this is really about changing the Marriage Act. And as I say, the Marriage Act is a very, very slim piece of legislation, really. It just basically says, you know, you have to be the right age and you're not allowed to be related to the person.
Yeah.
And, you know, and religious celebrants have the right to refuse to conduct a marriage, which happens all the time. You know, we have
only if they're registered as such, but that's a detail. No, you're certainly right. There are a few protections for individuals, though, in our anti-discrimination laws around the country, and that is a discussion, irrespective of the outcome, that we need to have.
But I mean, I'm just saying, you know, we're talking about two different pieces of legislation, and
well, in some ways, whether you agree with that statement or not is a statement of where you sit on the marriage equality question, because the no case is based on consequential knock-on effects. The yes case is based, as you said, on
The no case is I think there's a legitimate no case which basically argues that marriage is what it is and shouldn't be tampered with.
Yes.
I think then there's what I would have to say is probably the illegitimate no case, and that's the case that is exercising the art of conflation and adding in a whole lot of or maybes or possibles, or my child might be made to wear a dress. People want to marry the Harbour Bridge, which is the extreme, extreme expression.
I've never quite heard that one, but it's early days.
Well, no, actually, that someone did say that recently. I think one of our politicians said that next thing you'll know, people want to marry the Harbour.
Well, that's a throwaway line, but there is a group that says there are people who say, well, if society, and let me use your words, if society was to progress to the stage where polyamorous unions were regarded as the norm, or even not exceptional, that marriage would be redefined, could be redefined then to be between any group of people rather than two people.
And then that would be a conversation that we'd have to have as a nation, because the proposed changes to the Marriage Act would not allow that to happen. And so that would be a completely new and different conversation.
Given your argument that it's a matter of following the evolution of society, if society did evolve that way, would you support such a change?
My argument isn't that it's following the evolution of society. I was arguing that the institution was evolving and that we're all part of that. So it's not just the evolution of society.
Well, perhaps that's interesting, because a lot of people don't feel part of that. I know.
Indeed.
In fact, on both sides, of the debate, people don't always feel part of that, do they?
And remember, this is a conversation about civil marriage equality.
That's right.
Each of the churches will have their own conversation, and as has happened with divorce, there are church communities that have worked out that it's okay to remarry divorcees, and there are church communities that have decided that that's not on, and so faith communities. So, you know, this move is about marriage equality at the civil level. Each faith community will be free to have, and because of that provision in the Marriage Act, it's already, you know, they're protected whatever they decide. You know, the thing is, 70% of marriages are already done by civil celebrants. So overwhelmingly, marriage is a civil thing in our society, and so it's evolved in that. You know, in the last 20 to 30 years, it's evolved from being a religious practice to a civil practice or a secular practice.
But not for some people. I guess that's the critical thing, isn't it?
And their view will always be respected. So the churches that want to define marriage as between a man and a woman, or want to define that the woman should submit to the husband, that will be the way they'll do it. And those who think that divorcees should never be allowed to get married again, that we'll be able to practice that, which happens in my own church. You know, there are priests in this diocese who still refuse to marry divorcees, and we live in a mixed economy church.
Will you be making your church available for same-sex marriages should the law be changed?
Well, the Anglican Church hasn't had that conversation yet. In the Anglican Church, the view is that that won't be happening, and I don't have the discretion, as far as I know, I don't have the discretion to just say I will do same-sex marriages. I'm confined by my church, so I'm advocating for civil marriage equality, and I'm certainly going to advocate for marriage equality within the church, but that's not going to happen at the same time.
It would appear on the face of it that you'd probably lose that at the moment if that debate was to happen.
In Well, it depends at what level we had the debate, I suspect.
Yes, that's right. So because that sets up a conflict for you. Could you imagine the church splitting on this question?
Well, I'd hope not. You know, I live with people I disagree with. Hopefully people who disagree with me can live with me too.
Yes.
And schism is never an answer because...
No.
Every time the church splits off and thinks it's purified itself by separating from one group, they find that they're in with another group of people they suddenly don't agree with, and the splinters keep going. But the thing is, you know, the surveys tell us that 70% of the population and majority of most Christian denominations support marriage equality. So when we have the conversation in the church, who knows what will happen?
Well, Dr. Catt, I've really appreciated having the conversation with you this evening, so thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, too. Good on you.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.